02830CR, State v. Bradley A. St. George, arguing on behalf of Mr. St. George is Donald T. Lang, Assistant State Public Defender.
May it please the court, Don Lang appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant petitioner Bradley St. George. This case comes before the court following a verdict finding defendant guilty of fondling the 5-year-old daughter of his girlfriend. Unlike most cases of this nature, the child took the stand and claimed that the incident didn't occur, that the defendant did not touch her. The defendant denied the contact when he testified, and there are no eyewitnesses. So essentially, with the prosecution's case, the problem they confronted at trial was convincing the jury that the statements the child previously provided out of court were more reliable than the defendant's denial and more reliable than what she said in court. In the context of the case, two pieces of evidence gained, because of this nature of the case, it gained additional importance. One is the testimony of a county investigative worker, Tai Juani, who interviewed the child and talked about the technique he used, characterizing it as a nationally accepted technique that gathers accurate information. A second witness was a clinical social worker called by the state to explain to the jurors why or how a child who recanted the story could nonetheless have been telling the truth the first time, and tried to explain how that could occur. The defense in this case submits that two evidentiary rulings in this case deprived Mr. St. George of a fair trial, his constitutional right to prevent a defense. The first being the exclusion of testimony from a Dr. Stonefeld, who was called to respond to the testimony of Mr. Juani and Ms. Rapley, the clinical social worker. And secondly, the exclusion of testimony concerning a prior incident of sexual fondling involving the young child offered, consistent with Polzano, to explain the source of knowledge for the allegation independent of the charge defense. With regard to Dr. Stonefeld, as a preliminary matter, I guess, there's no question that his testimony was relevant. This isn't a case where the defense was plowing new ground by calling an expert. Dr. Stonefeld was called in response to testimony provided by the state's witnesses, particularly Mr. Juani and Ms. Rapley.
Counsel, when you say there's no doubt that his testimony is relevant, I suppose your opposing counsel would say, look, the definition of relevance is makes more probable than not a matter of consequence in the trial. Is it 907 or 902 or 1 or whatever relevance is defined as. But if the person doesn't assist the trier of fact, how can the testimony be relevant?
Well, I should break that into two parts. The substance of what he was called to testify about was relevant. The state put the issues in play themselves. His qualifications are the grounds that the trial court kept his testimony out, not because what he was going to talk about was not relevant or important to the trial. So that's my distinction. It's my contention that essentially the trial court misapplied the standard of 90702, and that essentially what the trial court and court of appeals majority have done is, rather than assessing whether Dr. Stonefeld possessed specialized knowledge that would assist jurors in understanding the evidence that was before them, the lower courts have essentially held Dr. Stonefeld up to some sort of vaguely defined ideal, and having held him up to that ideal, found him wanting.
Wasn't an expert, is that the point?
Excuse me?
He wasn't an expert for this purpose.
I think he was an expert for this purpose based on his training and experience.
No, but what did the trial court think?
The trial court concluded he was not.
And they went through a fairly lengthy colloquy as far as why they thought, as far as his experience, his training, his actual involvement in cases like this. And that, so you're indicating that the court, of course, erroneously exercised its discretion in that area.
I'm indicating the court erroneously exercised its discretion and misapplied the standard in part.
Well, because the court's... Tell me the standard.
The standard is whether or not the proffered expert, Dr. Stonefield, based on his training and experience, has specialized knowledge that would assist the trier of fact in understanding the evidence.
And that's what the judge made his decision on, was that very point.
And my concern is that that wasn't the focus of his inquiry. His inquiry was more that he didn't specialize in child abuse cases. And my contention is, while that may go to the weight jurors may want to give his testimony, it's supposedly fodder the prosecution could have used for cross-examination, that assessment of Dr. Stonefield's credentials against the applicable liberal standard for admissibility of expert testimony, that unquestionably he meets this standard.
Now, let me just, he's obviously there to counter the other expert, right?
Excuse me.
He's there to counter the testimony of another expert. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. What was the other expert's qualifications? And did the other expert ever interview this child?
There are two state's witnesses he was countering.
Okay.
And this is sort of a curious inconsistency, I think, in the prosecution's case. On the one hand, we have Mr. Giovanni, who has a BA degree in psychology, who had taken, at the time he interviewed the child, at least, a 1 4-hour course in this interview technique. And I guess this was only the second child he had used the technique with. And yet he's able to offer this opinion about the nationally recognized nature of the technique and that it elicits accurate information.
How long did he see the child?
The child was 5 years old.
No, how long did he interview the child?
Well, that was one of the concerns, that the interview apparently lasted between 20 and 35 minutes.
Okay.
And part of the concern here is that, as described by Mr. Giovanni, this interview process supposedly has 5 parts, that there's a rapport building phase, there's a discussion of information describing body parts phase, and then the interviewing. It's difficult to conceive how he managed to gather or complete all these processes in this 20 to 35 minute period.
Well, who was the other expert?
The other expert was a clinical social worker who was very experienced in interviewing children, and based on her experience and reading, could speak to the issue of recantation. And I guess we have no objection that she's qualified to present what would be like Jensen evidence to explain to jurors how this could possibly happen.
Which one of these witnesses was the one that had read the read a scientific journal on this?
That was the second, the clinical social worker.
Okay. All right. That was her relation to this method of testing?
Basically, the study that she read would demonstrate that children do recant even when they tell the truth.
Okay.
The premise for the study is that there's substantiated cases of abuse that is the core group for the study. And I guess that's one of the concerns of confusion that the defense was designed to address. And that is, you can't draw a conclusion because a child recants that her testimony that she gave, or the story she gave before, was the truth. That the study or any discussion of recantation doesn't prove that. And at page, I think, 330...
What were the statistics she gave? They were quite telling, I thought.
Well, and that was the concern, is the statistics, unfortunately, don't necessarily suggest what people would construe them to suggest. And even the judge, when he's engaged in his colloquy and ruling, I think it's on page 330, has some concern about, well, why'd you bring these statistics? They sort of suggest that there's this percentage which recanters are actually telling the truth. And unfortunately, that's not really what the stats show. And the stats confirm that children will occasionally recant even though they told the truth. But it doesn't tell us that this child, because she recanted, we can infer she told the truth. And that's one of the core things that Dr. Stonefield was designed to respond to, that there's just not a conclusion you can draw about that.
Mr.
Lang.
The Myers.
Mr. Lang, what do you maintain as the standard of review in regard to whether or not Dr. Stonefield's testimony should have been admitted? Are you claiming it's a de novo?
I think it's de novo review. I think to the extent it implicates defendant's right to present a defense, that the standard is independent review at this stage, yes.
Isn't the standard usually erroneous exercise of discretion where you're talking about admissibility of testimony or evidence?
Normally it is. And I guess that's one of those troubling things that in the case law, sometimes the distinction gets confused. And in a civil case, that would clearly be the standard. And we like to talk about even playing field. But the reality is, in criminal cases, there isn't an even playing field. And any evidentiary ruling is made within the gloss of a constitutional safeguards. And the Sixth Amendment is one of those safeguards. That you can't exclude proffer defense evidence that's relevant unless there's some compelling interest. And consequently, this court has to scrutinize, to protect that interest, applies an independent review to the exclusion of defense evidence that implicates the right to present a defense.
So in other words, you're taking the approach that Judge Kane took at the Court of Appeals in his dissent.
That's correct, exactly. In the course of making an evidentiary ruling at times, the trial court may have to make a credibility determination. And if that's the context, I think the trial court's findings may be entitled to deference, because the trial court would have the first-hand ability to assess credibility. But the extent we're applying a legal standard, as this case is, then an independent review is warranted.
Counsel, I want to follow up on that. In reading the dissent of Judge Kane, it certainly appeared to me that his analysis was, as he wrote the opinion, was, let me look at the facts again. Let me look at the proffered testimony of the expert Stonefield and the purposes for the proffered testimony. And then I conclude that he should have been allowed to testify. It seemed to me that as Judge Kane was writing the opinion, what he was doing was substituting his view of whether or not the expert qualified for the view of the trial court. And that's the way that I read his testimony. Read his dissenting opinion. Is that what you mean by de novo review?
What I mean by de novo review is applying what the objective record shows and applying it against the legal standard of whether or not he possessed information that would assist jurors in understanding the evidence.
Well, I
don't know that it's a personal judgment. Had trial judge said, you know, Dr. Stonefield, I don't really buy your claim that you have these credentials. I think he would be bound by that, and that the reviewing court would be bound by the trial judge's finding in that regard. And he said, well, you know, I believed him when I read the transcript. That would be applying his own personal judgment. Accepting what the doctor testified to and what the record shows and applying that to the legal standard of 90702, within the gloss of defendant's right to present a defense, that's what the Judge Kane has done.
What is the gloss of the defendant's constitutional right to present a defense? What are the words that comprise that gloss? What's the analysis that constitutes that gloss?
Well, essentially, it's the right to present relevant evidence important to the defense. And
then
obviously, that begs the question, is this relevant testimony?
Okay, I think arguably you set out more than that in your brief. And arguably, Judge Kane sets out more than that. You talk about the strict scrutiny. You speak of, on page 14 of your brief, the compelling you weigh the compelling interest of the state, you know, the strict scrutiny against the interests of the defendant. What is unclear to me is what is the framework for the standard of review. Is the framework for the standard of review, reviewing court looks at it and says, I think that this witness was good enough, and it's the old let it come in and let the jury decide the weight. You know, that's what normally is done, right or wrong, wrongly. Or is the analysis, look, normally their admission of evidence is erroneous exercise. And if you look at it from erroneous exercise, well, probably the trial court's ruling was okay. But the gloss is you have to have erroneous exercise plus. That is, you have to look at the erroneous exercise, but then apply this compelling state interest, because there must be a compelling state interest to overcome the fundamental constitutional right to confrontation and compulsory process, as you cite on page 14. So what's the analysis for that?
And that's not precisely clear, I must confess. But in this case, if there's a rational basis to let the evidence in, it ought to come in with the right to present defense. I guess I don't concede that he didn't erroneously exercise his discretion, because I think the trial court's application in 90702 focused on the fact that he didn't specialize in child cases. And that's not the criteria under 90702. It's whether you have specialized knowledge that would assist the trier of fact. And in this case, Dr. Stonefield, a guy with 30 years experience plus as a psychiatrist who talks about his case being mainly clinical practice, patient practice, who 90% of his work involves the whole process of interviewing individuals, who had experience in child abuse victims, albeit only two or three apparently were children that he actually treated. And that was just his base knowledge. With that base knowledge, he didn't just stop there. He did 20 hours of preparation for this particular trial, reading relevant treatises, abstracts to prepare
for it. He didn't read the same matter that the clinical social worker did. He didn't read the same article she did.
No, and the fact he didn't read that particular study, I don't think, precludes him from testifying on the basic concept to which she discussed, and that is recantation.
But I think the point, just so I understand, Judge Keene's point, and I think your point, is that if there is any so-called shortcoming of the expert, that can be developed, obviously, at trial. In other words, doctor, you didn't do this, and doctor, you didn't do that. But then the ultimate question is whether whatever he has to offer, the doctor's expertise or relevancy would then still get to the jury. In other words, the doctor would not be automatically disqualified by the judge. That seems to be Judge Keene is saying that these shortcomings would be pointed out to the jury.
That's precisely my position. That the extent he may not have credentials completely analogous to the ones that a state expert might have isn't the test. The test is, does he have knowledge based on his training experience, years of work as a psychiatrist, that would assist the finder of fact? And the fact that his credentials may be different than the state's doesn't preclude him from testifying, that the state then can question him about those distinctions and try to...
How does that lock up with the judge being the gatekeeper? In other words, if we would use that standard, then almost every decision that the judge would make, look, this expert is not qualified. But how do we get around that? What test would we use there?
Well, that's a legitimate question. I guess the Judicial Council Committee notes sort of suggests that under this standard that we apply in Wisconsin, expert testimony is usually going to come in unless it's superfluous or a waste of time. I know the state cites the concern with, well, the psychiatric testimony, and courts have been a little reluctant to admit it because of its somewhat dubious nature at times. But I guess that's not really the issue that's presented in this case. We're not talking about like a Daubert issue about whether the science of
that still is, in other words, using the argument here, that would be, as a former trial judge, I would think, well, that would be very difficult because, on one hand, I'm to look at that and I'm to make the final decision, but this person, this expert, may have something that he or she wants to offer. And that's the decision. You're saying, look, as long as we understand this, but that'll be taken care of in cross-examination or at trial.
Well, again, there's two distinctions here. One is the distinction between the substance of testimony, and the other is the qualifications of a particular person to speak about an issue which the substance, there's no doubt it's relevant. In the Steele case, ability to give testimony on intent, we concluded it's not relevant. And no person, no matter how qualified, is able to give that
opinion. Thinking about when I recall during the early phases of the operating while intoxicated, there was an expert, can't recall his name or where he was from, but he was usually brought in by the defense. And I remember going through this and then ultimately making a decision that I guess he wasn't qualified, okay? And I'm trying to distinguish that situation, which dealt with the intoxilizer 5000 or whatever it was, and this type of consideration where, you know, I really am concerned that the state can pile on. In other words, you've got these experts and now you can't adequately present a defense. But the problem is you just, you have to have somebody that has, what are you saying, some knowledge? Some knowledge is enough just on that one area?
I guess you're suggesting, could he have called any psychiatrist and it wouldn't matter who they were and they could come in and talk about this? And I think there probably is a limit to that, of course. If you have a Skinnerian who just loves studying the rats in a maze and that's all he's ever done in his career, he's never interviewed anybody, he's never talked to anybody, he's got a psychiatry degree, but all he studied is rats. I think a judge could say, well, you know, this guy doesn't have anything to offer. He's got no knowledge, really, about the subject of interviews. It's beyond what the jurors know. This particular doctor, I don't think there's any question. He knows the subject of interviewing, which is the subject he's going to be talking about. He knows the notions of recantation from studying literature, which is founded upon his core knowledge already that he has as a practicing psychiatrist for 30 years. So the question is there a reasonable basis to determine that this guy can assist jurors based on his knowledge? If there is a reasonable basis to reach that conclusion, he was entitled to present this doctor, particularly since the whole subject matter, which necessitated the doctor being called, was testimony presented by the government itself.
Could I ask you a question about your theory of the defense right to present evidence? Would the standards for the admissibility of hearsay any different for the defense than for the prosecution?
The standard itself wouldn't be, but there are instances, and I guess Chambers versus Mississippi is one of those, where a hearsay rule at times may have to be foregone to let defense evidence in if the evidence is relevant and sufficiently reliable. So that the rules of evidence can't be, I guess they use the language, mechanistically applied to keep out relevant defense evidence. The state doesn't have a Sixth Amendment right. I mean, their liberty is not at stake, and the prosecutor doesn't go to jail if he loses the case. And consequently, the Sixth Amendment does create additional protections for the defense to present relevant evidence.
One other question. Would there have been some other way to rebut the state's expert testimony other than an expert witness?
The most compelling is to have your own expert with credentials do so. I mean, It's always dangerous practice for defense counsel to try to rely on cross-examination, because if the expert for the state doesn't give the kind of response you want, you're stuck with that. And obviously, defense counsel here wanted to present his own expert to be cautious, or to caution jurors that there's certain conclusions you can't draw from what the state's presented to you, and to be cautious about what those conclusions are. And that is, doing this cognitive graphic interview technique doesn't magically transform what this girl said out of court into some reliable evidence that you can take to the bank, because the technique doesn't guarantee the trustworthiness of the responses. It may, if done properly, limit the chance that the interviewer infected the process, but in this case, we don't even know if that happened, because he didn't, in accordance with the protocol, videotape the process, so somebody else can't come back and review and see if he wittingly or unwittingly tainted the interview.
Was there any objection at trial to either one of the state's witnesses?
No, there was not, no. And as I say, consistent with Jensen, certainly the clinical social worker can talk about recantation to inform jurors. And likewise, Dr. Stonefield can present testimony to inform jurors, wait a second, there's certain conclusions you can't fairly draw. I think on page 38 of my brief, Dr. Myers in his treatise talks about this concern about rehabilitation testimony, and that there's this danger that jurors are going to draw a conclusion beyond that which really the testimony allows. And that is, because the child recanted, somehow that means that the testimony before was true or the statement before is true. That's just not a valid finding you can make from the fact of recantation.
Mr. Lang, if I could follow up one quick question, Chief. You said that it wasn't your position that the defendant's right to present a defense, and this was in response to Justice Prosser's question, you're not arguing that the defendant's right to present a defense, constitutional right to present a defense, somehow changes the underlying evidentiary standard of admissibility here that governs the trial judge's discretionary decision-making. You're arguing that in certain instances, such as this, it overrides it? Is that?
No, no. I think I'm just saying that a reviewing court independently applies review to see if the standard was correctly invoked. Now, in terms of the hearsay context, for instance, Chambers recognizes just because the evidentiary rule keeps it out, or the rape shield law, as we talk about in this state, just because that rule may keep something out, there are instances where the evidence is reliable and relevant, the defendant nevertheless is entitled to present it. That the only justification to keep it out then, and there has to be some compelling state interest at stake to justify it. I assume in this context, if the defense brought five experts to talk about the same thing, it may well be relevant, but there's a point at which the state has an interest in terms of the length of the trial to prevent cumulative evidence. The defendant couldn't argue all my right to present was infringed because he was able to present his defense then to the jury. That's not the situation here, of course. Dr. Stonefield was precluded from testifying.
It presents kind of, though, an untenable situation for trial judges, because what are otherwise considered discretionary judgment calls that trial judges make every single day, but then are subject to this second layer of analysis. So what you're suggesting is the trial judges should be doing the second layer of analysis?
They have to exercise caution, and in some instances, the second layer of analysis. This case probably didn't require a second layer of analysis, because I think if the trial judge would have properly applied 90702, that Dr. Stonefield would have testified. But whenever defense evidence is excluded, the court has to exercise particular caution that the evidence isn't relevant and important to the defense. And to exclude it is at risk of reversal. Sometimes the exercise of discretion is talked about the limited right to be wrong, or in the context of a right to present a defense criminal case, the liberty interest is at stake, and so that right to be wrong is very narrow. And that consequently, that's why we have independent review in this context where we wouldn't in other evidentiary contexts. My time is long since I'm slow.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Representing the state is Gregory and Weber.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. There are two pages
of the trial transcript that I'd like the court to make particular note of. Both of them are found at record 124 on appeal. The first page is 315. The second page is 319. Those two pages tell you all you really need to know about Dr. Stonefeld's qualifications to serve as an expert witness in this lawsuit. It is difficult for the state to understand how Dr. Stonefeld can be qualified as an expert witness on recantation in a child sexual assault case when he had attended one seminar 10 years before, the substance of which he did not remember. That's record 124 at page 315. It's difficult to understand how Dr. Stonefeld can be qualified as an expert witness on interview techniques in child maltreatment cases. I got it backwards. His seminar was, I believe, on interview techniques. It may have been on interview techniques or recantation. One of the issues in controversy to attend one seminar 10 years before didn't remember the substance of it. He was pro-offered as an expert witness on this article, on Tina Sorensen and Barbara Snow's article on how children disclose sexual victimization. The defense wanted to offer him as an expert to rebut information in this article, and he'd never read it. He'd never read it. That's page 319 of record 124 on appeal. Justice Bradley asked a question about relevancy in the context of this case. The state would submit that unhelpful testimony from an unqualified expert witness is just not relevant. It's subject to exclusion under the rules of evidence under 90401. It's possibly subject to exclusion under 90403 as a waste of time. A defendant's constitutional right to present evidence, whether you consider it in terms of compulsory process or due process, a defendant's right to present evidence does not extend to irrelevant evidence. That's Washington versus Texas. In this case, the circuit court exercised its discretion in concluding that Dr. Stonefeld was not qualified as an expert in the two areas of inquiry, the two relevant areas of inquiry. Justice Wilcox spoke earlier about the quality, the detail in which the judge considered the question. If the issue was whether the court exercised its discretion, we probably wouldn't be here. We probably wouldn't be here today. In terms of the constitutional standard of review, and Mr. Lang and I were talking before the argument about why the court took this case, what was the real issue that interested the court? And I guess my conclusion from the first part of the presentation is that the court is concerned about the standard of review. To the extent that the circuit court exercises its discretion in a manner consistent with state law, with the controlling principles of law, with the statutes, and with the facts of record, the state submits that the defendant's constitutional guarantees are adequately protected, at least insofar as the expert witness qualifications are concerned. Now, I understand the court's concern in this regard because there's case law that A, makes constitutional questions subject to de novo review. The reason for that, as I understand it, is to guarantee that the constitutional protection, the level of constitutional protection, doesn't vary from case to case. And I submit that in this context, at least when we're talking about the qualifications of the expert witness, the defendant's constitutional right to present a defense is adequately protected if the state properly exercises its discretion, if it does not exercise its discretion erroneously.
What cite do you give for that?
I look to Chambers versus Mississippi's analysis of the purpose of going beyond the state court's evidentiary rulings, the state court's own body of law, And the court seems to be stressing fundamental fairness and reliability in the presentation of evidence. The citation that I'm looking at from Chambers is 410 U.S. The pinpoint site is page 302. It obligates a defendant to comply with established rules of procedure and evidence designed to assure both fairness and reliability in the ascertainment of guilt and innocence. I'll repeat it. The defendant is obliged to comply with established rules of procedure and evidence designed to assure both fairness and reliability in the ascertainment of guilt and innocence. The standards in 90702 are intended to do just that.
Are you suggesting, I just want to make sure I understand, that if the trial court made a ruling that could be upheld, could be and be viewed as following the correct procedure and within the ballpark of the rule of evidence, that correctness is sufficient safeguard for the constitutional guarantees?
At least in the context of 90702, because what the judge is saying here is that this pro-offered expert witness has no relevant testimony to offer. He is not qualified as an expert in the areas of inquiry. He has no relevant evidence to offer. Anything that he would offer would not be relevant. And a defendant's constitutional right isn't burdened to exclude that evidence.
I'm sorry. Let me push you a bit with regard to Judge Keene's dissent. Judge Keene, page 1 of his dissent, I think it's in the brief of the petitioner on appendix.
Got it.
Says, citing from Johnson, says, normally we're talking about a discretionary ruling of the court. But he says in that quote, but the court's authority may not be exercised until it accommodates the accused's due process rights to present a defense. Without a compelling state interest, the court's ruling may not interfere with the accused's opportunity to present crucial evidence to the jury. That suggests to me that even if there is a ruling that may be arguably consistent with procedure and evidence, enough in the ballpark to be sustained under erroneous exercise, that the gloss that your opponent may be referred to is you still have to, when it involves this constitutional dimension, you still have to then take a second step and assess whether there's, without a compelling state interest, the court's ruling may not interfere with the accused opportunity to present crucial evidence to the jury. In Johnson, it was the lineup, the pictures of the lineup in the trial court, I think excluded it, and it was overruled. And we said that, look, this was crucial to the defense. So normally we might say, okay, erroneous exercise of discretion. It's in the ballpark, good enough. I mean, I'm being a little loose. But the next step is that it involves something that was crucial to the defense. Do you agree with that analysis for 90702?
Not for 90702.
Do you agree with that analysis for everything else but 90702?
Justice Prosser asked about hearsay, applicability of hearsay rules. And I can conceive of a situation, I'm sure Mr. Wang can as well, I can conceive of a situation where a court could exercise its discretion with respect to an evidentiary ruling within the body of Wisconsin case law and still run afoul of a defendant's constitutional right to present a defense. What's on? Well, it's not. The court made an exemption, if you will. With respect to the evidentiary issue, or the evidentiary question here, the qualification of an expert witness, A, the state's compelling interest in this regard is to make sure that relevant, reliable evidence is put before the prior fact. I think the state has a compelling interest in seeing that the evidence that the fact finder gets is relevant and reliable. A defendant has no constitutional right to present irrelevant evidence. And I submit as a basic proposition that expert testimony presented by a witness not qualified to testify as an expert is irrelevant. And therefore, its exclusion does not violate the Constitution. And so, if I can finish, in the context of 90702, I believe that the defendant's constitutional right to present a defense, whether you consider it compulsory process, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, whatever, that the defendant's right to present a defense insofar as the presentation of an expert is concerned, that the constitutional right is protected if the court correctly applies the controlling law, 90702, facts of record, put them together, reach a decision a reasonable jurist could reach.
Only with you're not saying that we were protected, are you? For all rulings on inadmissibility of evidence?
Not, I'm trying very hard to limit it to 90702. And literally, and I joked about this before, it was difficult to identify precisely where this court's interests lie in this case. We've spent all of our time now talking about the expert witness issue, nothing about the Polizano issue, and apparently the court's focus is on standard of review. I'm not prepared to parse out every evidentiary rule and say for all time and all people that a proper exercise of discretion in this regard adequately protects the defense right to present defense. I can't do that.
One final question, and that is, if Dr. Stonefield had 10 courses 2 years ago, so you couldn't argue or wouldn't argue based on qualifications, you agree, don't you, that what the area of his proffered testimony was crucial to the defense, if otherwise qualified? What
yes.
He wanted to offer was, I want to talk about recantation, how it applies to the truthfulness of the original accusation. And he wanted to talk about interviewing techniques and the invalidity of the interviewing technique used here. That was his proffered testimony, which my sense is crucial to the defense. And you agree, absent here, your qualification is you wasn't qualified to testify.
I'll meet you halfway. What the defense wanted to do was put Dr. Stonefield on insofar as recantation is concerned. He wanted to put him on to rebut the statistical information from Sorensen and Snow. I will agree with you that in this case, certainly the general issue of recantation in child sex assault and the recantation here were relevant issues, were issues in controversy. And the investigative interview techniques in child maltreatment cases and the investigative interview technique used here was an issue in controversy. The state's position has been consistently that Dr. Stonefield is not qualified to testify as an expert on everyone.
I gather that the state's position is at a simple level, and I don't mean simplistic, simple level, when you have irrelevant testimony, that's the end of the ball game.
For purposes of both a statutory analysis and a constitutional analysis.
It's gone. And there are loads of cases that say if it's irrelevant or if it's cumulative, you don't have a right to. It's just done. I understand the defense's view. They say it was relevant because he was qualified. and then you get into a different kind of issue as to what the standard of review might be. Is that where the dividing line between the two parties is?
I think that's where we're at. I'm sure 2 hours from now I'm going to be thinking about the standard review issue and coming up with something else I want to add. But yes, I think that's where we're at in terms of the points of controversy.
Why don't we, for the moment, say this, he was qualified, just for the moment, and yet he was qualified on recantation, and he was qualified to talk about the statistical evidence, let us just say. And the trial judge here ruled him out of order, excluded his testimony, right?
Okay.
All right. If that were the case, you could make a better argument than the state is willing to concede now on relevance. What would the standard of review be?
I believe, well, for the statutory standard, obviously, we may still exercise discretion. For the constitutional standard.
It is a constitutional standard. That's the first thing we have to accept. That rules of evidence, when you're dealing with a defendant in a criminal case, you do have a constitutional loss in here. Even on relevancy, that is, or cumulative, there's a constitutional loss. Okay.
Given the assumptions that you're stating, I would assume...
Are they your assumptions, too? That there is a constitutional...
You're saying it's a hypothetical that he's qualified.
Yes, but I mean, you agree that this is a constitutional loss.
Yes.
Okay.
Given the situation that you describe, I suspect that the court would probably treat the decision in this case as one that would be facing de novo review.
But... You're in this particular case, your state's position is you don't get there because you don't satisfy the relevance.
Yeah, that's relevancy.
Now, relevancy, we've got two lines of cases. I don't remember which that most recent case says. You know, one line of cases is an issue of relevancy is a discretionary one, right?
Whether evidence is relevant is a discretionary determination.
You have other cases that say, no, it's satisfying this legal standard and we review de novo.
Most often, I think appellate courts treat relevancy as a discretionary determination.
Most often, right?
Most often. The best characterization of relevance that I have seen was made by the Court of Appeals in State versus Shale, S-C-H-A-E-L, somewhere in the 130s, I think, where the court called relevance probative worth.
Called it what?
Probative worth. The quote is, relevance is probative worth. And I like that, because I think that it ultimately bottoms out the issue that we have in this case, the probative worth of the pro-offered evidence, which, as I've argued, the state sees as minimal. I'd prefer to spend my time answering the court's questions.
You want to talk about Polizano?
Could I ask one other question here? Could the defense have rebutted the expert testimony of the state in any way other than an expert?
Absolutely.
How?
Cross-examination of the state's witnesses. Ms. Rapley, you're not suggesting that Sorensen and Snow have presented a way of determining whether a recantation in an individual case is truthful or false, are you? The answer would be no. The questions to Mr. Joni, who performed the investigative interview, isn't it a fact that certain types of questions can be expected to elicit inaccurate answers? Isn't it a fact that there are all sorts of protocols that are available to interview children, and you have selected one? The defense could have, on cross-examination, probed his familiarity with the techniques.
Is
Is this the case, counsel, where in closing argument the state relied on the fact that there was no rebuttal testimony offered to Rapley and Juni's testimony, and therefore that's part of the analysis of your opponent, why it is essential or crucial? Because here, in closing argument, they stood up and said, look, you've got these two experts, and it's not rebutted. They didn't offer any evidence against it, which gives greater weight to the argument of how important or crucial it was to the defense.
The defense in this case had a built-in argument. They had a recantation. They had a child who made an allegation of sex assault, who recanted it, who got up on the stand and, again, recanted it, the bits and pieces of her testimony that came through. This is, it's certainly not a mind-run prosecution for child sexual assault. Most cases don't involve recantations. But the fact that there was a recantation in this case was strong evidence for the defense. Were these areas crucial? They were certainly important.
Well, you had Rapley saying, look, of those cases where there is recantation, 92% were really the subject of sexual assault. That's pretty powerful evidence. I mean, 92, I wish I got 92 on everything.
I think what Rapley said was that in this research group that Sorensen and Snow had, 166 validated cases of sexual abuse. In the article, Sorensen and Snow say that 22%.
20 to 24, they recant. And of that group that recants, 92%, as I recall, it's found out that
later of re-adopted.
The people recant, 92% were really sexually abused.
And then, going back to what Justice Prosser said, could the defense have done something with that short of offering an expert? Sure. Cross-examination. Ms. Rapley, you are not suggesting that the Sorensen and Snow article provides any method for determining whether a recantation is true or false in a given case, are you? And the answer would have had to have been no.
Is there any other way other than cross-examination that they could have...
Argument. The defense was certainly free to argue as to any weaknesses in the analysis, or to argue that simply because in this limited group you had a high level of people, or you had a identifiable group of recanters and a much higher group of people who then readopted their original position, that doesn't mean that this particular child, Kayla's, recantation is truthful or false. You can't single it out to the individual case.
Well, suppose you had I brought in a statistician, PhD, world-recognized statistician, and I'm going to bring him in just to explain. He doesn't have to read the article. Just is going to explain that where you cite statistics like this, 22% of 160 people studied recanted, and 92% of that group was later shown to have told the truth. When I hear that, I figure, well, the profile of a recanter is they told the truth the first time, because 9 out of 10 did that. In this study, it's pretty good evidence. 9 out of 10 do it, then I can draw the conclusion, more probable than not, maybe beyond a reasonable doubt, that she told the truth the first time, right? That's what I got to believe as a jury, right?
Prosecutor never argued that.
No, but don't I have to believe? Isn't the whole issue here her credibility and his?
I don't think that that's the conclusion that would necessarily be drawn from the context of Rapley's presentation of that testimony.
Well, that's what I'm driving at. So I'm bringing in a statistician that's going to explain to lay people like myself who don't understand statistics what it means when you say 22% recanted, 92% of that group was telling the truth the first time. Will you accept that?
In truth, I don't even think you need an expert to do that. I think you can, a lay person will understand that even if you have a given group of people that act in a particular manner that's statistically identifiable, that doesn't correlate into this person's...
Maybe. I'll concede that, but an expert won't hurt to explain that. Why isn't the state willing to do that? I mean, I'm trying to get an expert, like Justice Prosser indicates, I'm trying to get an expert that the state is going to accept. None at all, to explain to the jury what this means and that it doesn't mean necessarily what any one individual is going to do. Doesn't necessarily mean that 90% shot that she's going to have told the truth.
Our position would be that you would not even need an expert to accomplish what it is you want to accomplish.
I accept that. Can I have it anyway? Do me a favor.
Under 90403, we could exclude that as a waste of time, as unnecessary. We could exclude it under 90701 and 90702 as not...
You're not going to let me do it.
I would not, no. I would not. I would be more inclined, Chief. I would be more inclined... were I sitting as judge to allow expert testimony on the interview techniques that were used, but only from a qualified expert. If this court looks at decisions from New Jersey, like State v. Michaels, since the 1980s, there have been questions about investigative interview techniques that are used. It's more of an area of inquiry where expert testimony can contribute something to the equation.
Why was the state's evidence relevant? If everybody knows that it's irrelevant that 9 out of 10 people do something, it's irrelevant to prove whether this person did it. Why was your evidence relevant? Now, I know there was no objection, so I can't deal with that. That's why I asked that question. But suppose I objected.
If you had objected on grounds of relevance, I suspect that the witness's reference to the statistical information might have been subject to exclusion as irrelevant, because it does not contribute a definitive answer to the issue in inquiry here, which is whether Kayla's original allegation or her recantation is truthful.
What about the caseworker's testimony about the reliability of the interview technique?
The defense should have objected to that, and the defense probably should have gotten its objection upheld to that. It was a gratuitous comment, I'm sure made by Mr. Juni, because he learned in the context of that training that this particular technique was designed to better ensure reliable information. I think that, if he characterized it as that, it's an interview technique that's designed to better ensure reliability in an investigative interview. I don't think that's objectionable. He was vouching for the, well, and I'm not even going to say that because I don't know what his intent was in identifying it the way that he did. And I know when we go into analysis about whether you have improper commentary on credibility, you look at purpose, and I don't know what his purpose was. My guess is he was just saying what he'd been told by the teacher of the interview technique.
Counsel, I'm concerned about the easy mantra of, look, no one has a constitutional right to present irrelevant evidence. I mean, that's catchy. And it might be correct, too, for the lesson. But I'm not sure in terms of the analysis, because I look at the first issue in this case, the Pulisano case, right? And that case, as I read it, we apply the five factors. The real guts of that is the third factor. It's not relevant.
the fourth factor falls in because it's not, can't be necessary if it's not even relevant. So that whole inquiry, the whole Polizano thing, issue here, deals with whether or not that proffered evidence is relevant. And the court said, well, it isn't relevant because you don't, a five-year-old doesn't, an average five-year-old would know what a private part is and know what touching is. So you don't need to bring in these other contact to show an alternate source of knowledge, you know, precocious information. So it's not relevant. Yet, you can see that the standard of review with regard to the admissibility of that information and that question, which is a relevance question, has a constitutional dimension. You say whether the circuit court's exclusion of evidence in this case violated St. George's constitutional right is a question of constitutional fact reviewed de novo, page 5 of your brief. So there is a ruling based on it's irrelevant, and you still get to the constitutional dimension. If you do it on that first issue in this case, why did he then say, oh, the second issue, though, you have no constitutional right, and as soon as it's deemed irrelevant, you don't have any other inquiry? It seems like it's inconsistent.
Trying to think of a principled basis to distinguish between the two. And I'm not sure I can. The question of standard of review in the expert witness area, from a constitutional perspective, I don't know if it has been addressed by this court since Johnson, and Johnson was a Court of Appeals decision. My sense is that this court, simply for continuity's sake, may want to adopt a Johnson-style analysis when dealing with expert witness qualification issues and the constitutional implications of it. I've been kind of mulling during the course of the argument, and I don't want to flip-flop on my position, but so much of it in terms of qualifications, in my mind at least, ultimately does turn on relevancy. And then the question becomes twofold. Who's in the better position to determine relevancy in a given case, the appellate court or the trial court? How can this court best protect the interests of other litigants by encouraging continuity of protection? I mean, I think that's where I started the argument when we're talking about standards of review. If this court is not satisfied with my articulation of the position, then I welcome an opportunity to file a supplemental brief, because in truth, I didn't think that this was where the argument was going to go.
What's the Johnson analysis? Quickly in your mind, if you can. You're reading from page what?
130 of Don's brief, paragraph 38 of the slip opinion. Court of Appeals seems to be saying that you have to identify, first of all, whether the court has exercised its discretion correctly. Then the court has to take into account the due process right to present a defense, we'll call it the constitutional right to present a defense. And the court seems to be saying that there has to be a separate inquiry as to whether a compelling state interest justifies exclusion of the evidence, notwithstanding the defendant's constitutional rights.
But that constitutionalizes every evidentiary judgment call that the trial court makes, doesn't it?
Yeah, but when I come to this court and argue waiver, you never listen. If a defendant is saying, I object to this, the admissibility of this evidence on 907.02 grounds, commits himself to that in the trial court, and then somehow the argument metamorphosizes into a constitutional argument in post-conviction proceedings and on appeal, there may be a basis for a waiver argument. In truth, I have to give this some thought. If the court desires additional briefing, the state stands ready to provide it.
And nothing's easy.
I'm sorry?
Nothing's easy.
Nothing is easy, Chief. I thank you.
Thanks. Just think about us. We're going to have to write the opinion. Mr. Lang.
Since I burned up all my time on this issue, I just wanted to say I rely on my brief for the proposition that a five-year-old saying that an adult wiggled and jiggled her private parts implicates the logical and weighty inference that the child wouldn't have known that unless that conduct had occurred before. That I don't think we can assume that jurors would all necessarily assume that five-year-olds would be aware of that kind of behavior. As to this issue, I want to make it clear I'm not suggesting the defendants get a break and they get to introduce irrelevant testimony. The question here is, who decides? And my contention is that whether or not the evidence was relevant or not is subject to independent review by this court. And that's really the critical part of this, is that the trial court has a responsibility to protect defendants' rights, and if it does so, there probably isn't going to be a matter to review. But that a blunder in this regard requires special protection, and the independent review provides that protection. In this case, quite frankly, I think the trial court abused its discretion, if you want to go back to the lesser standard of review, because the court focused essentially on what Dr. Stonefield had done professionally, as opposed to what it is he had done and what he had to offer the jurors in this case. The question was posed several times, gee, are there other ways defense counsel could have done this or responded to these experts? And, I think counsel states right, he could have cross-examined and addressed this issue. The problem is, at the time these experts testified, he didn't realize he was going to be without his expert at the close of the case. When the case was introduced, he identified Dr. Stonefield as one of the experts that was going to be speaking, and I don't think he mentions him by name in the opening, but he refers to the fact that an expert's going to tell you, you can't, from this recantation, draw some conclusion that the juror, the child's telling the truth. And so while hypothetically, perhaps his defense could have been presented some other way, at the time Dr. Stonefield was excluded, he'd gotten past that point. There's no chance for him to go back and try the case another way. And again, Dr. Stonefield's testimony, the discussion came up here with the statistics, and gee, what is the juror supposed to draw from this? And the whole point of his testimony was to say, well, their statistics, they have no role here. That you can't draw any conclusion statistically about the likelihood that this child did or did not tell the truth. And one of the problems, of course, the way the case was tried without his testimony, we don't have that clarification that occurred. And in fact, in some ways, the state sort of exploited the situation on both his rulings, because in both instances, the state in its closing sort of says, well, we have the unrebutted Tai Juani, who says this is a nationally recognized system for gaining accurate information from children. And this is the unrebutted testimony of Ms. Rapley concerning recantation. And again, it is a study that one of the problems, it's just sort of misleading, and unless you really look closely at this, the whole study is premised on substantiated cases. The whole point of the trial is to decide whether there is a basis for substantiation. So the statistics really should have been excluded in the first place. The problem is they got in the case, and the defense was precluded from the chance to try to explain or address that problem.
How did the defense deal with the fact that it had said it was going to introduce an expert and then the expert wasn't there?
It didn't. I mean, there wasn't much it could do. And that's sort of the dilemma you get caught in when you create this anticipation and then it gets refuted. And I guess in this case, my contention is it was rejected inappropriately, because Dr. Stonefield brought to bear enough information that he could give jurors an understanding of what it is they were hearing from the state's witnesses. That because you do this particular technique doesn't give some magic of reliability to the child's answer. And because some kids have recanted, and even though they told the truth, doesn't mean that this child's recanting means that she told the truth. And so for those reasons, Your Honor, I think the trial that was conducted in this case ended up being an unfair trial. The state raised various issues in terms of how the jury is to view the child's out-of-court representations and recantations, and the defense was precluded from presenting an expert who could clarify, qualify, put them in perspective for the jurors when they go back to the jury room and try to assess what it all means.
Did the state know your experts, the defense experts' qualifications before trial?
It's not clear. The challenge to his qualifications sort of popped up at the 11th hour on the eve of his presentation. There had been no prior challenge to him. Dr. Stonefield's name had been mentioned, I believe, June 8th or something. There was a motion hearing or status hearing. At that time, he was identified as the defense expert. And there was no, you know, objection raised at that point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Thank you, Mr. Weber, for your arguments in this case.